Testing, 1, 2, 3, testing. The second part of the interview with Theodore L. Elliott took place on July 30th, 1986.
I have two sort of broad oil type questions to do before we go into the present. Or did the oil shot business in the late 60s? Was there any concern that OPEC countries might successfully organize and force the corporations, oil corporations, to make concessions to them? Was there any concern about the power of OPEC or the possible power of OPEC in the late 60s?
Well, I confess to you, I've forgotten exactly when OPEC came into being.
1961, I think.
And there was, in those, there were issues like the expensing of royalties and so forth and so on, most of the details of which I've forgotten. And I think certainly into the late 60s, there was a feeling that the oil companies would have to give a little bit today and a little bit more tomorrow in order to maintain their longer term position. But I think there was also a feeling that OPEC was not sufficiently united. It didn't have sufficient leverage on the oil companies to really create a major upheaval in the industry.
Now, you also mentioned yesterday that the Shah's basic purpose in terms of oil was to get more revenue. Did you ever get a sense that he wanted that revenue for weapons purchases? Did he ever get that sense? What his goals were?
Oh, his goals, I think, were yes, indeed, reflected in his military program, but also in his civilian and his development program. And one of our policy objectives was to convince him that he should not go overboard on the military side.
Okay. Now, in August of 67, the Shah made a visit to Washington. Do you recall much about the visit, about that
particular visit? I'm not going to help much on the specifics of one visit or another. If I were sitting here with the agendas of those visits in front of me, I might remember more. I do remember, for example, on one of his visits, he gave a speech in the on the 8th floor of the State Department to a large group of American businessmen, and I remember being very impressed with the way he sold Iran to the American business community. Very effective. And of course, these visits, while LBJ was president, their relationship was so good that it was always a very pleasant and very happy visit, but I don't recall the details.
What kind of preparations did you have to make these types of visits?
Oh, an enormous amount of work was involved. First of all, on the substantive side, making sure that the American officials, the President, the Secretary of State, usually the Vice President was involved, would be given written briefs on the various substantive issues. And then an enormous amount of work on the logistics, although the protocol office of the State Department was also involved in that. If there were any problems, the Iranian ambassador would be on my telephone very rapidly. So this required, each of these visits required an enormous amount of time. I know he came in August 67, June 68, that's right, their visit. And I can't remember whether I was involved in one after that or... I don't know why I remember three Shah's visits while I was country director.
I'm not sure about that.
And then Hoveyda came in, I believe, December 1968, at the tail end of the Johnson administration.
He was the foreign minister.
No, he was the prime minister, Amir Abbas Hoveyda. Just a couple of vignettes, which I think were kind of interesting. In June 68, the Shah came, among other things, to get an honorary degree at Harvard University. And this was a very difficult period, Vietnam War, and the Shah was not exactly a popular fellow in the student body in Cambridge. And nobody at Harvard can remember before or since the kind of security that surrounded the Shah there with people on the rooftops and so forth and so on. And he tried to make some kind of flashy major new international proposal, remembering that George Marshall announced the Marshall Plan at a Harvard commencement. It didn't go over very well. In fact, it has been so thoroughly forgotten that I can't even remember what it was. But there was also a bit of a pall over the occasion because Bobby Kennedy had just been shot. And so it was a difficult occasion. There were some demonstrations against him, but they didn't amount to very much. And one of the amusing vignettes is in the course of making preparations for this meeting, that very pushy Iranian ambassador, Hushang Ansari, went up and went into the home of President Pusey of Harvard, which was on the campus, the president's house, to look at the arrangements for the Shah in terms of what bedroom he'd be in and so forth and so on, and announced to the Puseys that the Shah would sleep in the Pusey's own bedroom, please, because that was obviously the best bedroom in the house. And that's just an illustration of the kind of fellow Ansari was, and the kind of a regime it was, that Ansari would feel he had to do that in order to please his master. The Hoveyda visit, I remember one element in it, which I haven't read anywhere, and somebody would have to go back into the records of the conversation to get the precise figures. But Hoveyda suggested, mind you, this is December 1968, long before the oil crisis of 73, that the United States buy oil from Iran at the then prevailing price, which was $2 or whatever it was a barrel, and put it in salt mines in the United States as a strategic reserve. And when you think how much money we would have saved had we done that at that time, he suggested this to Secretary Rusk, who responded that was pretty complicated, it would take congressional authorization and so forth and so on, and the idea was, as far as I know, never followed up on.
He wanted to make a long-term contract, basically.
He wanted a long-term contract, which would, of course, boost their oil revenues, so it would it was in their interest, but Hoveyda was trying to persuade us that it was also in our interest to have a strategic oil reserve, and of course he was right, but we weren't listening in 68.
I saw one declassified document having to do with one of these visits that showed, that listed various topics of conversation with Iranian officials, what topics to avoid, what topics to emphasize. Topics to avoid were like freedom of the press, party politics, praising any one individual Iranian other than the Shah. What kind of problems were involved in these kinds of visits? Did that show that there was some kind of problem?
I think on the latter point, praising individual Iranians, there was a feeling, certainly would have been my feeling at the time, that if we had said Mr. X was a fine fellow, the Shah would make a little mental note, oh, Mr. X is in the Americans' stable, and that would quite possibly prejudice the Shah against Mr. X, not because the Shah didn't enjoy and want very close relations with the United States, but because he wanted to be absolutely sure first loyalty was to him. Now, as far as conversations about the internal political situation in Iran is concerned, obviously this was always a sensitive question with the Shah, and it goes back to the efforts in the Kennedy administration to put pressure on him. And if I recall correctly, our main thrust was not so much to suggest new things to the Shah, but to encourage him to move in the reformist direction that he seemed already to be wanting to move in. And at least into the late 60s, he was bringing into his government people who were interested in reform in the economic and social fields. So it looked to us, certainly as late as 1969, that basically things were moving in a good direction in Iran, even though, of course, there weren't political parties and free elections and things of that kind. And at least the people in charge knew what they were doing and had a long-term view. All of that changed in the 70s.
Now, you mentioned that when the Shah visited Harvard, there were anti-Shah demonstrations.
Yes.
Did these demonstrations, these were by Iranian students and so forth?
Well, I don't know that they were at Harvard necessarily Iranian students, because of course a lot of American students looked upon him as the dictator he was too, and also they were just attacking anybody who was a friend of the Johnson administration, which was sending American boys to Vietnam.
But in terms of the Iranians who were in the U.S. who were involved in anti-Shah political activities from overseas, did this create much, any diplomatic problems between the U.S. and the Shah?
Well, it did. I remember one or two of his visits, certainly. And I just remembered what the third visit was. The third visit is he came back for a presidential funeral. By then it was the Nixon administration, but I was still country director. Was it, must have been Truman.
Or Eisenhower.
Or Eisenhower. And let me just say something about that, because it suddenly came back to me. I was assigned, he came in, I think, to Friendship Airport in Baltimore, and was helicoptered into what was then the Naval Observatory up Massachusetts Avenue. It's now the Vice President's home. And I was assigned to go up and be the official welcomer. And I'll never forget the Shah stepping off that helicopter in full military uniform with medals and banners and God knows what else just dripping from his chest, and thinking to myself, my God, this guy is beginning to go over the bounds of megalomania and self-importance, which of course is always the first step in the direction of the collapse of a dictator. And he looked like a comic strip character as he stepped off that helicopter. And I remember that really bothering me, and yet I had to balance it against the good things that seemed to be going on in Iran at that time. Now, there were some Iranian student demonstrations in that period. Hushang Ansari, I think, handled them a lot better than his predecessor did. He tended to get into conversations with some of the leaders of these groups and try and talk to them about their country and where he thought it was going and why he thought their views were extreme. But it was just beginning to build up momentum, which of course became a major feature of the American scene as the Khomeini revolution got its momentum.
Okay. Now, in late 57, you mentioned this briefly yesterday, the British announced their decision to begin phasing out their military presence in the Persian Gulf. Did they give the State Department much forewarning about this?
I think we knew, again, I don't remember the exact dates, but I think they consulted with us at length, because obviously we had a shared interest in the strategic and petroleum aspects of the Gulf region. And so we had lots of discussions with them in the Gulf region, among ambassadors and embassy staffs, and in London and Washington.
How much concern did this decision cause in the U.S.?
Well, I think it caused a great deal of concern because we didn't know what would fill this power vacuum in the general sense, and we didn't know what arrangements the British would be able to work out in the various emirates along the Gulf, which they were involved with. And then there were some specific issues like Bahrain, which the Iranians had a claim to. In due course, as you know, the United Arab Emirates got sorted out, and the Bahrain issue eventually went away. But and American policy focused in on a security system in the Gulf, which would be maintained by the two major Gulf powers, Saudi Arabia and Iran, the two-pillar policy. And I think by the time the British actually withdrew, arrangements were in pretty good shape. Some of these median line problems had been sorted out. And the Iranians grabbed Abu Musa and the Tunb Islands, which created a little flap, but there wasn't much the Arabs could really do about it. And the situation, I think, by the mid-70s had sorted itself out into a reasonably amicable relationship, as reasonably amicable as any relationship between Arabs and Iranians could be. I mean, they're two different cultures with lots of problems and historical animosities.
Were there any efforts made to persuade the British to maybe postpone their withdrawal or phase it more gradually or something like that? Or?
Again, my memory isn't good enough. I'm sure there were, I'm sure, but I'm also certain the British had made a firm decision for the usual budgetary
sales of payments. What kind of feelings did the Iranian officials have about this decision? Did they consult with you about their stance towards the British decision?
I don't recall any specifics. My general impression, looking back, is that the Iranians would have thought this was a welcome departure of an imperialist power, and after all, it's the Persian Gulf, and what are the British doing there anyway? The Shah's main international strategic concern was the Soviet Union, and he would lecture us on the weakness of the Arab states, including Saudi Arabia, and the possibilities that he saw existing for Soviet intrusion into the Arabian Peninsula. That sort of thing worried him, but I think he felt, you know, he and Iran could take care of the basic security problems in that region.
But he's not really sold on the two-pillar policy himself. He thought, well, in terms of one-pillar...
I think he always felt Saudi Arabia was a little unweak country, and as for those sheikhs, I mean, there. It's interesting how history has turned out, though, isn't it?
On the June 68 visit, this might be details that you've seen, yeah. But there was apparently a request by the Shah for a very large credit arrangement, in a range of like $500 million, $600 million in credits to be dispensed annually at like $100 million a year. But he wanted to raise the credit levels that had been allocated earlier in the 60s. Do you recall anything about the details of those negotiations, or the thrust of them? Or
now that you mentioned the figure, it rings a bell with me, but I don't recall the details. But that would also have been standard operating procedure. He always wanted more, and our job was to try and put those figures into two contexts. One is exactly what kind of military equipment do you need? What is the threat? And what are the kinds of equipment and training and what have you needed to meet that threat in the military sense? And secondly, are you balancing your allocation of resources between development and security? And that debate was never ending. At times he would come in with major requests, try to put public pressure on us. Other times it would be handled through more confidential channels. But it was a constant pressure from him for more.
So this came out to the British decision, because that had some bearing on his desire to expand the credit ceiling.
I think it would have been one of the rationales he would have used, that he was facing an increased threat because of the weakness and instability of the Arabian Peninsula states.
Now, you mentioned your impressions of Shah at the end of the decade. You mentioned the 69 visit, your impressions of him. Did you make visits to Iran during the late 60s periodically? I think you mentioned something about this yesterday.
I probably went two or three times. The last time I remember going there as country director was when Secretary Rogers went there in probably April 69. I was still country director, and I flew to Afghanistan, and Rogers was going Islamabad, Kabul, Tehran. And I joined his party in Kabul and flew with him and briefed him on the airplane between Kabul and Tehran. And I participated in this meeting with the Shah in Tehran. It was not a long visit, if I remember correctly, but that was the last visit I made as country director.
Did his meeting with the Shah have any particular significance, or sort of a get acquainted type meeting? Or
it was the first, the Shah never let an opportunity go by to give you his belt on Shawang and also ask for more aid of various kinds. I don't remember any specific major new items on the agenda.
In terms of your visits to the country in the late 60s, 69, did you get what kind of a sense of things? What were your impressions of Iran at this time, compared to the early 60s, say?
Well, my impression was of a country that was very dynamic and very much on the move, and the pace of economic development, the pushing forward not only industrially but agriculturally, turning around in their balance of payments situation, the way Iran was going out for credit in the money markets of the world, the trained people who were coming back from study in Western Europe, the United States, and participating in senior levels. It was a very exciting prospect and a very encouraging prospect. And I remember, in fact, this was after I was in Afghanistan as ambassador, traveling, it must have been, by this time it must be 74 or 5, traveling on an Iran airplane between Frankfurt and Tehran on my way back to Kabul. with Reza Amin, who was, had been number two in the Industrial Mining Development Bank, and then set up what was known as the, or became the first head of the Arya Mir Technological Institution, which was the Shah's MIT, or that's what it was supposed to turn into. And Reza had been educated as a nuclear engineer here at Berkeley. And Reza and I were discussing, you know, the two countries, we said to each other, that it's really fun to be living in and be playing a role in the 20th century are Iran and the United States. And we really both felt Iran was an exciting, dynamic, forward-moving country. Now, there were, of course, as the 70s proceeded, there were increasing signs of disquiet. And I don't know whether you want to get to those now, but there was a watershed in there around 73, 74, 75, and obviously neither the Shah nor most Americans realized at the time that there was a major change occurring.
Before we get to that, yeah. In terms of the late 60s, though, the feeling is a concern about instability that prevailed in the early 60s, they had pretty much faded away.
Pretty much faded away. The country looked very stable, and largely because the pie was getting larger and more people were sharing it.
Okay. And this was pretty much a consensus opinion in the administration.
Among
experts on Iran.
Oh, there were a few. You know, there were a few people who, both Americans and Iranians, who believed that the dictatorial nature of the regime contained the seeds of its own eventual destruction. But it was pretty hard to convince most Americans and most Iranians that the regime was about to fall.
I have a few questions about the early Nixon administration, since you were a country director in the first six or seven months of
Yeah.
During the first months of the administration, did you see any shift in policy towards the Shah and Iran, or was it
No, I think there was real continuity between the Johnson and Nixon administrations. The two-pillar policy was very much in place when Nixon took over. And Nixon had known the Shah very well. He visited him many times, both visited with him, both in Washington and Tehran, when he was vice president and when he was out of office during the Kennedy and Johnson period. Nixon knew and liked the Shah very much. And Spiro Agnew got along well with him, too, for whatever that may portend, and he really had the same kind of relationship with Nixon that he had with Johnson, in some ways maybe an even stronger relationship, because I think the Shah respected Nixon's international experience, which of course Nixon had in greater measure than LBJ.
Now, during the summer of 69, it might be a little late, but Nixon made a speech at Guam where he announced what was called the Nixon Doctrine. To what extent was policy towards Iran shaping up along the lines of that approach?
I think very much so. Now, I moved to the executive secretary position just about the time of that speech, and but I felt at the time that was right up the Shah's alley. That's exactly what the Shah wanted to hear from an American president, that countries like Iran under his leadership would be expected to carry the burden. That also put the Shah in a very good position to say, now here's what I need to carry that burden.
Okay. Now, in the early Nixon administration, who were some of the key decision makers on Iran issues, that, like other agencies or the NSC? Do you remember any names in particular?
in the State Department, Joe Sisko was the assistant secretary, and he and Jack Nicklaus, who succeeded me, were the key players. In the Defense Department, there was a guy named Warren Nutter, who was assistant secretary for ISA, and Nutter did get involved in some of these Iranian matters. But basically, the policy was set by a Nixon-Kissinger team in the White House that wanted to support the Shah.
You know who the NSC was involved in the Iran issues? Was it Harold Saunders? Was you the person?
I guess Hal was still over there, yeah. But it was like the Johnson administration. There, nobody was really nobody at a senior, senior level was playing devil's advocate.
Okay. Now, did the shift in power to Kissinger in the White House have any particular impact on the shaping of policy, or maybe any impact on the State Department's role in Iran?
Well, it had an impact on the State Department's role across the board. And in this case, it didn't matter quite so much because I think the State Department and the White House were on the same wavelength. There's another player in there, too, which became increasingly important in his years, and that's Richard Helms. Because the CIA had always had a very, very close relationship, we discussed some of that earlier, with the Shah, with Iran. So the Shah knew Helms, and Helms knew the Shah very, very well. And I think Helms played a role as director of the CIA, which would have reinforced the predilection that already existed in with Nixon and Kissinger to support the Shah.
Now, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, during 1969 through 1973, you served as a special assistant to Secretary Ross?
Well, I was the executive secretary of the State Department, and the special assistant secretary goes with that title. But basically, the way to look at my job, I was the chief of staff of the State Department.
So you reviewed policy in all areas?
I ran the information network liaison alert system for the Office of the Secretary of State, and in his absence, the Deputy Secretary. And I was the liaison between the seventh floor, the executive floor of the State Department, and the White House. Most of my dealings with the White House were with Al Haig, Kissinger's deputy at that time.
During this period, do you recall any particular Iran issues that came up, or was it just...
Again, of course, there were issues, and particularly in the military assistance field, and as you know, it's been well documented elsewhere. I wasn't particularly involved in the decision process. As you know, Nixon and Kissinger virtually gave the Shah a blank check. But again, I don't recall. There might have been some at lower levels, but at senior levels, I don't recall any devil's advocates. I don't recall Rogers, Laird, Nutter, Helms, Sisko, Kissinger, anybody saying, are we overdoing it?
Okay. What was your next assignment after?
And then in the summer of 73, I was appointed ambassador to Afghanistan.
During this period, did any issues involving Iran come to your attention? Were you involved?
The only issues involving Iran during the period I was in Afghanistan were those involving Iranian-Afghan relations. And one of the, if I can say just a few words about that, one of the principal policy objectives of the United States vis-a-vis Afghanistan was to limit and diminish the dependence of Afghanistan upon the Soviet Union so as to increase the chances that Afghanistan could maintain its independence vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. So we were looking for ways for Afghanistan and supporting ways in which Afghanistan could become more closely linked to, for example, Iran and the Gulf Arab states. In that period, I believe in 74, but I'm not absolutely certain on my dates anymore, the Iranians and the Afghans began talking about a major program of economic cooperation in which the Iranians would provide major economic assistance, including to build a railroad link between Mashhad and Kabul and to develop other Afghan resources. They also were bringing to a conclusion a long, long, long negotiation on what to do with the Helmand River waters. The Helmand River rises in central Afghanistan and peters out in a bunch of pools and lakes in southeastern Iran, in the Sistan area. And this was a long-standing dispute between the two countries. So there was real reason to hope that Iran and Afghanistan would start cooperating, and that this would be another link with the non-Soviet world for Afghanistan. And I was encouraging this, and I was in touch with Ambassador Helms and later Ambassador Sullivan in Iran to encourage it. And the Shah didn't need much encouraging. He saw the strategic importance of this also. He was very worried about the Soviet presence in Afghanistan. In fact, during his visit in 69 to Washington, I had a brief conversation with him about the fact that I was about to go out to Afghanistan. And this was right after, he must have come back to Washington in the summer of 69, now that I think about it, because this must have been in, my guess is, in August of 69. And Mohammed Daoud had just thrown out the king and had taken over power as the first president of the republic. And the Shah considered Daoud pro-Soviet, and he took me aside and told me how worried he was and what a difficult job faced the United States, and how he was concerned about the future of Afghanistan. So we had no trouble. He was already convinced of the importance of Iran having good relations with Afghanistan. But the cultural differences, historical differences, and you know, the Iranians looked upon Afghanistan as some kind of Appalachia, and the Afghans tended to look on the Iranians as a bunch of effete, the typical thing, one Afghan could lick 20 Iranians with one hand tied behind his back. The problem of overcoming this cultural problem, the foreign minister of Afghanistan once pointed out to me that when he was with the president of Afghanistan, he would shake his hand, look him straight in the eye, whereas the foreign minister of Iran had to virtually kowtow head on the floor when he was speaking to the Shah. And this kind of cultural difference was very hard to bridge, and so lower levels in the Iranian bureaucracy tended to drag their feet, and not much ever came of this effort. On the Afghan side, there was also great reluctance to get into bed with the Iranians. So that's one of the sort of sad chapters of that part of the world, that those two countries couldn't cooperate more closely with each other. The Afghans used to worry about the Iranian tie with Pakistan also. So of course, the Afghans have had a major dispute, long-standing dispute, with the Pakistanis over the Pashtun tribal area. So we tried to help these two countries get closer together. We succeeded in some minor ways, but not in the major strategic way at that time.
After Afghanistan, what was your next assignment?
After Afghanistan, I was briefly 5 or 6 months Inspector General of the State Department. And at this period, Iran was falling apart, and the communists had already seized power in Afghanistan. And then I was asked to become dean of the Fletcher School, and I actually left the service in October 1978. And I was packing to go to the Fletcher School in early January 1979 when I got a call from the State Department to come on in. And this is when Secretary Vance, through Undersecretary Newsom, but at the recommendation of Ambassador Sullivan, was suggesting that I go to Paris to see Khomeini.
Going back to October in the fall, how surprised were you by the outbreak of the revolution?
Late
summer, early fall.
I don't want to duck that question, but I think it's fair to say I was not following Iran in any great detail. It was absolutely clear by some time in the fall that the jig was up. I had heard about problems while I was still in Afghanistan. I believe that preceding spring, I believe I wrote Bill Sullivan a letter saying I had heard the Shah had cut off his subsidies to the mullahs. This word had trickled back to me, I think, through the Iranian ambassador in Afghanistan. And I remember thinking to myself, that's a terrible mistake for him to have made. And I was also aware, our oldest son spent a junior year abroad or something from college at what was then called Pahlavi University in Shiraz. And I heard from him sort of at the student level of some of the ways in which the students in Iran were laughing at the excesses of Bashar. There were pictures of him standing on a cloud, looking heavenward, you know. This stuff became a butt of jokes. Now, dictators start falling when their people laugh at them. So I was aware of a good deal of disquiet. I was aware of growing problems. And then when the Qom riots and things began, I wasn't alone in being aware. But that the regime would deteriorate and fall that quickly, I think, was a, I'm sure it was a surprise to me.
Now, in terms of the special mission to Khomeini, which you mentioned a minute or two ago, what did Ambassador Sullivan think could be accomplished with it?
Well, I don't want to I don't want to rely on my, I'll say a few words about it, but I don't want to rely on my memory when it's been sort of well documented now, both Bill Sullivan's and Gary Sick's six books. The basic idea behind it was to try and preserve the Iranian military. And in retrospect, clearly it was a mission that could not succeed. I mean, Khomeini was not going to permit any rival power center like the Iranian military to exist in Iran once he seized power. But let me say a few things that haven't been in print so much about that episode. I'll have to quit right after I answer this question. Sullivan and Vance and Newsom, Saunders, Henry Craig, the State Department crowd, all felt this was a very important mission. Some effort had to be made to establish contact with Khomeini. Even if the substance wouldn't succeed, we needed the contact. Sullivan had been requested to ask the Shah if it was okay with him for me to undertake this mission. And the Shah had said, fine. In fact, if I remember correctly, he said something like, you'd be foolish if you didn't try something like this. The White House president was down in Martinique at some summit meeting, James Garrett and others. And Brzezinski was down there with him, played a key role, and determined that the mission should not go ahead. Vance then called me into his office to explain to me why the mission shouldn't take place, and I confess to you, I've never understood the reasons that Brzezinski and presumably Carter offered for their decision not to have me proceed with the mission. But obviously, the mission didn't take place because the president vetoed it. Vance's explanation was such that I didn't really understand the explanation. When I left Vance's office, I was with Henry Precht, and Henry said he figured it was just a question of one chief of state not being willing to conspire in the overthrow of another chief of state, and that's the best answer I've heard. Now, there are a couple of vignettes here which are kind of interesting, I think. One is that it was my clear recollection from reading into the file, and mind you, I had to read a lot very quickly because I'd been out of the picture for a long time, that Khomeini had agreed to receive me, and this had been arranged through our embassy in Paris. Quite a considerable period later, I happened to be sitting next to Brzezinski at some luncheon, and this subject came up, and I told him what I just said. And he said, that's not true. He said, Khomeini had not agreed to receive you. If we had known that, would have put a different light on it, but certainly that the State Department had no authority to ask Khomeini if he were willing to receive it. So later I asked David Newsom what the facts were, and David Newsom answered it by saying some of the communication between the Secretary of State and the President was done without Brzezinski's knowledge. So I think I'm right on that. I think Khomeini had agreed to receive me. Now, if that were the case, what's going on in Khomeini's mind when the mission is canceled? And as you no doubt know, there has never been an official face-to-face American contact with Khomeini. There have been a couple of academicians who have seen him, but no official contact. So maybe we missed an opportunity to establish some kind of contact. Maybe would have made a marginal difference in Khomeini's view of the United States. The balance of the evidence is that it wouldn't have made any difference, that Khomeini needed the American devil, for his own domestic political reasons. But we'll never really know because the effort was never really made. And I think it's too bad it wasn't.
Any further comments? Or should
the only other thing I think I might say, and then I should stop, is that when I had this conversation with Vance asked me what he thought would happen when the Shah left Tehran. And I said I thought Khomeini would be on the very first plane. And Vance looked slightly surprised that I said that, and his next question is, what would happen next? And I used a word like there'd be a major brouhaha or something of this kind. by which I meant that the people of Iran would gather together in major celebration and so forth and so on. And my impression of Vance's reaction was that Vance, and I think Saunders too, had the pace of events had outstripped their ability intellectually to cope with them as well. And I think Gary Sick's book puts it all together very beautifully in terms of the disarray of Washington at that period. And the United States was just bereft of policy, bereft of influence over a revolutionary situation.
One last question. Sick's very critical of Ambassador Sullivan's role. Can you give me his assessment as fair?
I think Bill Sullivan was in an exceptionally difficult position because everything he sent into Washington would appear on the front page of the New York Times. And under the circumstances, I think he performed extremely well. But by the fall of 1978, the jig was up. There wasn't a darn thing the United States could have done to make it come out differently, in my opinion.
Julia, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.